Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with America's traditionally nonpartisan celebration of Independence Day, which was hijacked on the 4th of July by an authoritarian leader who cages children, talks about being president for life, is grooming his children for dynastic succession, says he will not accept the outcome of an election if he loses, has threatened to jail his opponents, and constantly attacks the free press, recently sharing his hatred of journalists with his despotic buddy Putin, saying we should, quote, get rid of them, and to top it off, holds military parades. Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale, whose latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, Is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Fascism Claim Too Extreme? ICE is not the SS or the Gestapo, but it has concerning similarities. We'll look into Trump's radical break with America's democratic tradition, since democracies organize themselves around respect for the dignity, equality, and freedom of all human beings, as opposed to fascism, which organizes society around the vilification of outsiders. We'll examine the similarities between powerful business interests and the institutions of state terror, with Wall Street giving billions in loans to for-profit prison companies who run detention centers, some with former high-ranking Trump administration officials serving on their boards. Then we'll investigate further state-sponsored terror on the U.S.-Mexico border with historian Monica Martinez, an award-winning author who is professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, whose latest book is The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. She joins us to discuss the fear engendered in immigrant communities about Trump's promised forthcoming mass roundup for deportation and her work on Mapping Violence, a digital research project that recovers histories of racial violence in Texas, and how that relates to the apparent turn for the worst within the culture inside the Border Patrol revealed in recent racist and callous Facebook postings. Then finally, we get an assessment of the coming titanic battle between the increasingly powerful health insurance giants and the Democratic candidates running for president who are advocating Medicaid for all: Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and in particular, Elizabeth Warren. Wendell Potter, the former chief spokesman for Cigna and head of corporate communications at Humana, who is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org, joins us to discuss the need for better arguments and strategy in advocating for a single-payer healthcare system in America. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, which was the winner of the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy. His latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And he has an article at the New York Times, Is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Fascism Claim Too Extreme? ICE is not the SS or the Gestapo, but it has concerning similarities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jason. And let's start with the 4th of July. I don't know whether you watched it, but it was sort of embarrassingly cheesy. It was almost like an 8th grade history lesson, bad history about the Founding Fathers, wrapped up into military adulation, when in fact the Founding Fathers, of course, opposed having a standing army. It was clearly an attempt by Trump to hijack the popularity that the military has within American politics and culture, hoping that it would rub off on him. But it also smacked of his adulation of despots like Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un. How did it strike you?
First of all, I'm not sure I can really assess the effects of his mass events on their intended audience, which is his supporters. I think that sometimes what comes off as crassness and vulgarity for his supporters may come off as anti-elitism, a thumb in the eye of the coastal elites owning the libs, as it were. So I think the vulgarity, the crassness, the upending of centuries-long tradition is part of the show, as it were.
So let's turn to your article. What I find interesting about it, and it's sort of worth sort of pointing out, I think, is that when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made this statement on July the 2nd after a visit to this migrant detention facility run by Customs and Border Protection in Clint, Texas, when she made the statement that the United States is heading towards fascism after seeing the treatment and these poor kids who've been denied diapers for weeks and running water and toothbrushes and all of what we've learned. And frankly, you know, for a Christian nation, it's pretty hard to swallow, because the Bible tells us to take care of the stranger, the parable of the Good Samaritan. These children are in our custody, so we all have a collective responsibility, and albeit a collective shame in the way they're being treated. But nevertheless, when she made that statement, it's worth noting that she was being heckled by Trump supporters, these kind of Proud Boy types that were out there heckling her at the very moment. So that is an interesting contrast to the fact that a lot of the local churches down there in South Texas near the border did bring food, clothing, blankets, toothbrushes, etc. to this facility, but the Border Patrol turned them away.
Yeah, it's inimical to the liberal traditions that found that are at the center of our democracy, because it's collective punishment against an entire group. You know, these are young, innocent children, and the idea is supposedly by punishing them collectively, one will send a message of deterrence to drive away further immigrants. As I argue in the article, this is a kind of reasoning that you found the Nazis employing in the pogrom of 1938 after Kristallnacht. In November 9th, 1938, in November 1938, they imprisoned tens of thousands of Jews in concentration camps with the express purpose not of killing them. This was 1938, after all, but of encouraging them by exposing them to brutal conditions to self-deport. And we see that vocabulary all the time. This is not, you don't treat humans like this. I mean, our rights are based, our conception of a nation, our values are based on the dignity of humanity, and not the distinction between us and them, not the distinction. But liberalism does not have room for a place that says that those who are not citizens can be treated in a brutal and inhumane fashion.
Well, of course, this is quite personal to you, isn't it, Jason, since your grandmother escaped the Holocaust, and she wrote that famous 1957 memoir of 1930s Berlin, where she pointed out the tactics by the Gestapo in 1937 were similar to what's happening today, because they criminalized Jews and arrested Jewish citizens for having committed minor traffic violations.
This tactic of smearing whole groups of people by highlighting the worst actions of some of their members is a tactic that is from the worst annals of history. This administration, when they talk about immigrants, constantly they're talking about MS-13. They're constantly talking about terrible, violent crimes, as if immigrants are more prone to violent crimes, when in fact the opposite is true. So they're trying to get us to think of a group of people, non-white immigrants, basically, as intrinsically prone to crime. And this is exactly what you see in the core of fascism. The core of fascism is you define yourself as a political community by characterizing an enemy and and vilifying that enemy and saying that our community, in order to remain our community, must keep that enemy out.
Well, you also point out that this development under the Trump administration of this police-like forces turning ICE and the Border Patrol into a kind of police force specifically to force outsiders into hiding, detention centers sealed off from public view,
right,
in
so
which to detain them, and an economy set up to profit from it, which is happening with these for-profit prisons.
That's right. So one thing one this is what one has to pay attention to as our institutions respond to an authoritarian, fascist, nativist ideology and rhetoric. My grandmother, in her memoir, speaks of rushing on Kristallnacht to the synagogue at which she worshipped to try to protect it from being burned to the ground in Berlin. And the SA were forcing a temple employee to run barefoot over broken glass. And she got a police officer to arrest the employee and bring him over to thereby protecting him, and bring him over to her apartment. And this is what we're seeing all across the country. We're seeing police chiefs standing up to ICE, because what ICE does runs counter to what police do. Police are trying to have safe communities. When you send immigrants into hiding, then they don't report crimes. And then crimes against them can be enabled and multiply. So what happens in a democracy when you have these anti-democratic forces like ICE, which is there, frankly, to impose a distinction between us and them, is they run counter to the ethic of police. And that's why we're having some very brave police chiefs standing up to ICE and saying, you know, this is not what we do. This doesn't make our community safer.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, who's the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, which was the winner of the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy. His latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And he has an article at the New York Times, Is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Fascism Claim Too Extreme? ICE is not the SS or the Gestapo, but it has concerning similarities. So given your grandmother's experience, which is extraordinary, and she's an extraordinary woman, clearly, what do you make of these full-page ads being taken out by right-wing rabbis like Shmuley Boitek, I think, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but full-page ad in the New York Times castigating her? How dare she use the term concentration camps? I thought that there was a separate term for Auschwitz and Buchenwald, etc., death camps, and that seems to be a better description. So why is he getting so upset about the use of concentration camps?
Well, he's protecting the Trump administration because of its connections to Israel. So, and the U.S. Holocaust Museum last Wednesday, which has Trump-appointed appointees, said we cannot issue denounced anyone who is using anything from the Nazi era to make analogies to the present time. And in response, hundreds of Holocaust scholars, the most distinguished Holocaust scholars in the world, signed a petition denouncing the U.S. Holocaust Museum's press release. So what does never again mean? I mean, the whole point of a U.S. government-funded Holocaust Museum in the nation's capital is to say we must learn from this history. How can you learn from this history if you're not allowed to draw on that history to make analogies between then and now? You cannot learn from it. It seals it off. Never again does not mean Hitler should never kill the Jews again.
Well, there are plenty of examples around the world of people being murdered because of their ethnicity
and religion. And that's right. And we draw on those of us whose families experienced the Holocaust and whose work deals with it, draw on that. We feel it's our historical and traditional duty to draw on those parallels where they're relevant. Now, history never repeats itself exactly. Obviously, it would be completely wrong, for example, to say that the ICE is the SS. I mean, the SS was a paramilitary force that then, and the SA, that were then given police-like powers, whereas the ICE was created by a government order in 2003. But when we talk about the function of ICE to be an interior police-like force whose job is to separate residents inside the United States from other residents of the United States, and is motivated by, as we've seen from their sister organization, the Customs and Border Patrol, there seems to be a large degree of racist sentiment, too much for a government organization. When we see those similarities, those of us who are conversant with 20th century history must call them out.
So in your article at the New York Times that I mentioned is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's fascism claim to extreme ISIS, not the SS or the Gestapo, but it has concerning similarities. Jason Stanley, I in the opening, I read an excerpt from it that democratic democracies organize themselves around respect for the dignity, equality, and freedom of all human beings, as opposed to fascism, which organizes society around the vilification of outsiders. This is a global problem, though, and it's happening in Poland and in Hungary, even though there are virtually no Muslim immigrants in either of those two countries. And that's a strange paradox. The further we get away from the idea that you're being invaded by outsiders, the more extreme seems to be the discourse. But let's take Britain, for example. As you point out in your article, in the 1930s, the head of the British fascist, Oswald Mosley, his platform, and he did pretty well in the elections, by the way. I think he came in third. Britain for the British. Now, that's clearly being revived as we speak. It was revived by Brexit, which was run on a racist platform. And now, of course, this dysfunction lives on. Boris Johnson, who's a sort of British version of Trump, might well become the next prime minister of the UK, even though at what 0.03% of Britons get to vote for him. This is a global phenomenon. When recently Putin said that liberalism is dead, I thought, well, you know.
Yeah,
you would know.
Right. So it is a global phenomenon, as it was in the 1930s. We have to remember that the Nazis were just the most extreme, murderous, genocidal versions of fascists. I mean, there were British fascists, fascist parties everywhere. In the United States, there was the America First movement. These were not every fascist party. In fact, most fascist parties are not genocidal anti-Semites like the Nazis were. But fascism is based, its principal thing is the division between the nation and the foreigner. And that's why all the fascist parties fascist ideology focuses on anti-immigration. Hitler is obsessed with immigrants. At chapter 2 of Mein Kampf, My Time in Vienna, he denounces Vienna as filled with foreigners. Not just Jews, but Poles and Romanians, and so the idea in every fascist party is to keep national purity, and foreigners are a threat to national purity. So when you see that ideology, that ultra-nationalist, ethno-nationalist ideology, which unfortunately has a major purchase in Israel as well, among a bare majority, there are many Israelis who oppose it. But it's spreading all over the world, and this happened in the 1930s as well.
Well, since we're talking about the UK, let's end on this note that the British ambassador to the United States, his cables back to the UK, talking about the Trump administration and giving the political leaders in the UK some idea about what's happening here. That's his job. He was saying that he doesn't believe that the Trump administration is going to become substantially more normal, less dysfunctional, less unpredictable, less faction-riven, less diplomatically clumsy and inept, and that Trump, in terms of being reelected, Trump may emerge from the flames battered but intact like Schwarzenegger in the final scene of The Terminator. And then he also wrote that, and we could also, but it also could be at the beginning of a downward spiral rather than just a roller coaster. Something could emerge that leads to disgrace and downfall. That's extraordinary, isn't it? Do you think that's the possible silver lining, that he is so extreme and so out of the American tradition that he's simply going to self-implode? Is Trump likely to, with his activated base, likely to get reelected?
That's outside of my area of expertise, but the leaders that are authoritarian, dictatorial, far right in these ways, or just even the far left leaders, the extremist authoritarian leaders who do the kind of clown show we saw on the G20, where his family members and loyalists were just like, you know, like it was a banana republic, right? But that is indicative of these leaders, and it doesn't make them any less effective as authoritarian leaders who seek dictatorial powers. And unfortunately, the Republican Party is largely acting to historical form, as the conservatives did in the 1930s in Germany.
Well, the playwright Bertolt Brecht wrote an extraordinary play about Hitler's rise called The Resistible Rise of Arturo Hui, in which he tried to reduce the Hitler character down to where he should be in the kind of lexicon of human existence, as opposed to we judge tyrants by how many millions of bodies they pile up, as opposed to who they were as people. And I must say there is an analogy there with Trump being so cheesy and such a discount celebrity, and Hitler being a failed painter and a failed artist who actually had to hire a Shakespearean actor to teach him how to elocute and goose step. And of course, that is the whole point of the Brecht's play, to reduce this man down to the absurdity that he deserves, as opposed to building him up. And here we are both talking about Trump, and in doing so, as Nancy Pelosi warned, as journalists, we are signing our own death warrant because he's trying to destroy us, and yet we talk about him all the time.
That's a incisive and powerful point upon which to conclude.
Well, thank you, Jason. I'm sorry I've been talking too much, but next time we'll let you talk more, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Urowski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, which was the winner of the 2016 Prose Award for Philosophy. His latest book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. And he has an article in the New York Times, Is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Fascism Claim Too Extreme? ICE is not the SS or the Gestapo, but it has concerning similarities. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back investigating further state-sponsored terror on the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's a waste of time, cause ain't no amount of dancing finna break the bondage. We go to war and transcend space and time, when every record ain't a record, just a shape behind. You know the stakes is high, we in the face of drama. That's why we can't shake it or escape the problem. It's like a game of roulette, the barrel revolving. They only wanna see us occupying a coffin. Mothers crying too often from they lost child leaving. I'm trying to get over, get under, get even. Get inside, getting it, getting dumb, getting greedy. We got to get it right, it's not about to be easy. Come on, that's the point.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Monica Munoz-Martinez, who is an award-winning author, educator, public historian, and active participant in developing solutions that address racial injustice. A national authority on the history of race, she's the Andrew Carnegie Fellow and the Stanley J. Bernstein Assistant Professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, where her research specializes in histories of violence, policing on the U.S. Mexico border, Latinx history, women and gender studies, and public humanities. Born and raised in Texas, she is the founding member of the nonprofit organization Refusing to Forget and is currently at work on Mapping Violence, a digital research project that recovers histories of racial violence in Texas. And her latest book is The Injustice Never Leaves You, Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Monica Munoz Martinez.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And our previous guest, who's an expert on fascism as in terms of how frail democracies are vulnerable to encroachment of fascism, and just in general, what would your comment be on where we stand as a democracy here in the United States? Clearly, we are in danger of becoming a plutocracy, but that is a separate issue. Well, maybe it's not a separate issue, but how do you see us in terms of our health as a democracy, in terms of the encroachment of fascism or fascist tendencies, shall we say?
Well, I'll say that we certainly are at a crisis moment. But as a historian of histories of racial violence, I would say that historically the United States has always been built on principles of white supremacy that have made access to citizenship, access, you know, claims to a full democracy, reliant on excluding racial groups from categories of belonging and from the protections of citizenship. So if we think about our histories of slavery and genocide and colonization in the United States, that for throughout our nation's history, we have not fully embraced and lived up to the ideals of full democracy that protected all humans. And so if we think about the long legacies of those histories, in many ways, the institutions that we're living with today still embrace those traditions. And so it's one thing to reflect on our current administration, but we have to think long and hard about the longer history that shaped our institutions of policing, incarceration, and our immigration policies that excluded people on the basis of race, sexuality, and religion. And we are, in many ways, returning to immigration policies and policing practices that historians and others had agreed were inhumane and immoral.
But don't we also have a history of slave labor, chief labor? You mentioned slavery, but also it seems to me that the main impetus has for people coming across the border is conditions in the countries from which they're fleeing. But here in this country, they don't our corporations, agribusiness, et cetera, restaurants, you name it, landscaping companies, a gamut here in California in particular, don't they depend in many ways upon undocumented labor because it's cheaper, you don't have to pay benefits, et cetera?
Absolutely. Throughout our American history, this is a nation that has been built by, thanks to the hard work of immigrant laborers. And so the history of Chinese immigrants that worked to help complete the railroad in the West, the recruitment of Mexicans to come to the United States to work in the railroads, in factories, but especially in agriculture. And so throughout our history, factories, especially during the Industrial Revolution, it wasn't just Chinese and Mexicans, but European immigrants that were fleeing devastation, in their own countries, or just coming to the United States looking for economic possibilities. And so if we think about factories and industries like sewing and fabric production in New England, those industries were really driven by immigrants. The exploitation of immigrants. And so absolutely, when we think about the reasons that people come to the United States, we have to consider the recruitment of that labor by employers and by industries that in large part are seen by Americans as being exclusively the work of immigrants.
And again, I'm speaking with Monica Munoz Martinez, who's an award-winning author, educator, public historian, and active participant in developing solutions that address racial injustice. She's professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, and her latest book is The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-American Violence in Texas. So how do you think that we can get through this situation here, where clearly the border is, the president doesn't want to solve the problems. He wants to exacerbate them because he's using the horrible, callous treatment of immigrants on the border in an attempt to deter people from coming. So cruelty is his actual policy. And as I say, he doesn't want to solve the problem. A glaring example is that the countries from which a lot of these immigrants are coming now, the Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, he's cut funds, and it would be logical to basically make life more livable for the inhabitants of these countries as opposed to deny funds and because they're riven with drug violence and corrupt governments, the people have to flee for a better life. And he's making life for those who flee worse than back home. And that's his strategy. So in terms of the your long perspective on how we treat immigrants and what goes on our southern border, doesn't happen on our northern border, I might add. How do you see the current situation in that historical perspective?
Well, unfortunately, there's a long history of state-sanctioned violence on the U.S.-Mexico border. So my own work recovers a period of racial violence, anti-Mexican violence, that was sanctioned by the state of Texas and condoned by local, regional, and national authorities. There was a militarization of the border between 1910 and 1920. And this is, of course, a decade that paralleled the Mexican Revolution in Mexico. And so there were, historians estimate about approximately a million Mexican refugees that came to the United States seeking refuge from the conflicts of war. And they were met with fierce anti-immigrant sentiment. But the part of the history of this is that it wasn't only Mexican refugees that were violently policed, some of them imprisoned in prison camps in West Texas, in Fort Bliss, outside of El Paso, but American citizens of ethnic Mexican descent were also violently policed. And so we now estimate that hundreds of ethnic Mexicans, both Mexican nationals and American citizens, were murdered by Texas Rangers, the state police of Texas, by local law enforcement and Anglo vigilantes. And these injustices were linked by the fact that agents that participated in these acts of violence and vigilantes were not prosecuted. And so it shaped and shook communities across the Texas-Mexico border, where you saw people witnessing murders and sheriffs then going on to remain in their roles as law enforcement officers, and the same with Texas Rangers and U.S. soldiers that committed atrocities not being prosecuted. And so it created a culture of fear. Anybody who looked Mexican was brutally policed. They were systematically denied due process. And there was largely the public supported this kind of policing because ethnic Mexicans were criminalized by politicians, by local residents, by the press. And so that criminalization of anybody who looked Mexican, suspecting them of being bandits or revolutionaries or a foreign threat, allowed this culture of violence to be pervasive. And one of the historians who actually celebrated the Texas Rangers, even he went so far as to call this a reign of terror. And it's a period of policing and violence that teaches us that state-sanctioned racial terror has lasting and wide-reaching consequences on communities, cultures, and policing, and that if we don't hold accountable agents, federal agents, authorities, local agents that participate and call for these kinds of violence, that patterns of violence will continue and will impact generations to come. And so that is part of what I see is so urgent today, that we need to make sure that we are, as a public, holding our federal offices accountable for the kinds of terror that they are inflicting on refugees, on children, on adults, but also on the policing of people who are living in the United States and who have roots in the United States, who are being targeted for deportation.
Well, this has become very, very acutely clear with this revelation about this Facebook group of Customs and Border Protection officers sharing their racist and callous attitudes towards immigrants who were being mistreated, particularly these young children. They referred to the father and the daughter, that iconic and incredibly disturbing photograph of the father from El Salvador face down in Rio Grande with his dead daughter clinging to him, a two-year-old daughter clinging to him. They referred to them as floaters. What's happening there to that culture? Can you hold the president accountable? Who's setting the standards for that kind of degradation of humanity? And is there a chance that the outrage, both to the photograph of the dead father and daughter, and to revelations about the treatments of how people in our custody, particularly children, are being mistreated? Do you think that might stimulate the better angels in this country? I see it in terms of a kind of Manichaean struggle between good and evil.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I'll be more pessimistic to say that, that the rhetoric that was being expressed in this Facebook group is abhorrent. It's horrific to think that and terrifying to think that there are agents carrying guns, who are walking around with the full authority of the law, that have these kinds of racist and misogynistic views. And there should be serious investigations into who participated in these groups. But it's also a difficult task when we hear the president of the United States consistently describe Mexicans as rapists and murderers and participate in this criminalizing language, in addition to hiring authorities who express these kind, participate in racial profiling. But I'm a bit more pessimistic because, there was national outrage last summer when reports about family separation policies took place. And for a few months over the summer, there was outrage, there were protests, there were calls for accountability. And then America turned away and lost track of asking questions about what was happening to those children that had been separated, how many of them had been reunified, and after they were reunified, what was the state of their condition? And as a nation, we have to think about what is our responsibility in trying to reckon with those policies. But I also think about the longer history of these failed deterrent policies that have humanitarian devastating consequences. So strategies like Operation Gatekeeper, for example, that was inaugurated in 1994, strategically started to increase border enforcement along parts of the U.S.-Mexico border that would funnel people through the desert in Arizona. And reports from, according to the United States Border Patrol statistics, since 2000, over 7,000 people have died trying to come into the United States. So that photograph of Oscar Martinez and his daughter, unfortunately, for people who study this kind of violent policing and these policies that are U.S. federal policies, were not surprised by that photograph. And the thousands of people that have died in the United States, the fact that that hasn't been considered a national crisis earlier speaks to the regular dismissal of immigrant life by Americans on a daily basis. And well, so I have to hope that we are at a turning point. But we do have to be calling for accountability consistently.
Well, Monica Munoz-Martinez, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Monica Munoz-Martinez, an award-winning author, educator, public historian, and active participant in developing solutions that address racial injustice. She's a professor of American Studies and Ethnic Studies at Brown University, and her latest book is The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with an assessment of the coming titanic battle between the increasingly powerful health insurance giants and the Democratic candidates running for president who are advocating for Medicare for all, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and in particular, Elizabeth Warren. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you want to follow me. Your laws are minimal, because you won't even think about looking at the real criminal. This has got to cease, because we be getting hyped to the sound.
So no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. All we got, no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org. The author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Ian, thank you for having me back on.
Well, thanks, Wendell. And if you look in the business press, these mergers that are going on now are extraordinary in terms of the power of these big healthcare companies that you used to work for. United Health is now the sixth largest company in the entire United States. It's just merged, and Aetna's merged with CVS Health, Cigna's merged with Express Scripts, and so on. And, you know, the kind of money we're talking about in market capitalization is extraordinary. The CVS merger with Aetna is a $70 billion. The Cigna with Express Scripts is $54 billion. These are incredibly powerful corporations, and they're getting more and more powerful as they do what's referred to as vertical integration. So they own more and more of the chain of health care from the hospitals through the pharmacies, et cetera. So they have essentially – well, let me put it this way. It seems like Elizabeth Warren – has declared war on them in her in the Democratic presidential debate recently. She basically said the truth, which is that the health insurance companies are in the business of making as much money as they can out of premiums and paying out as little money as they can in terms of claims and health care. And that is their business model. So to my mind, since you're a former insurance insider, isn't that a declaration of war? Isn't that existential threat to these big companies? Aren't they going to spend anything it takes to defeat her and defeat this idea?
You know, I think they absolutely will. And it is an existential threat to these big companies to a large extent. Now, not completely. These mergers and acquisitions that you've mentioned has really changed the healthcare landscape. This vertical integration that you mentioned is very concerning. If there's an upside to that, is that these companies are no longer just in the business of selling health insurance. It is becoming increasingly for these companies almost a side business. The largest division, or the fastest growing division of United, is Optum, which doesn't sell insurance. So these companies won't dry up and blow away when we get to Medicare for All. They'll still be around. They will be changed. But you're right. They don't like to have any change imposed on them, certainly by government. So they will spend whatever they can to keep the status quo or keep them in as much as possible in charge of our healthcare system for as long as they possibly can.
Well, it's not just, of course, Elizabeth Warren. Several of the other candidates running for president on the Democratic side also are in favor of Medicare for All. Some are against. Biden and Mayor Pete, for example, are against. But in general, if you go back, say, to Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, when they tried to float a health care plan, it was shot down by big insurance. And they remember they ran those ads, the Harry and Louise ads, that campaign. Right. Surely, as this presidential campaign heats up and this issue of health care becomes more and more front and center, won't Harry and Louise look like small change compared to the television onslaught against Elizabeth Warren and the others?
Oh, you're right. I've said that we need to be prepared for what I've referred to as the mother of all propaganda campaigns. It's already underway. When I say they, the insurance companies have joined forces with the big drug companies and the American Hospital Association and others that profit off of our healthcare system. They're pooling their resources under the name of an organization called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future. So keep an eye on that outfit. it'll be the central place where they will be doing their propaganda from. They'll be hiring a lot of PR firms and advertising firms to disseminate the work that is cooked up at that outfit, which, by the way, is run by a big PR firm called Forbes Tate in Washington, D.C. It is going to be an enormous effort on their part to try to protect their profits. The thing that is different, I think, is that more and more people are realizing that the insurance industry should not be controlling our healthcare system, and individuals and families are beginning to wake up to the reality of what that looks like, and so are employers. One of the new things that I'm doing, Ian, I'm serving as president of an organization called the Business Initiative for Health Policy. We seek and we are making the business case for moving to Medicare for All. So we're going to be in this fight, one of the things we're going to be doing is pushing back against this propaganda. I know how it operates because I used to be a part of it. I used to help create and disseminate it. So I know a lot about how this works, and I'm going to be hopefully in a position to help Americans understand just what's going on and what's at stake.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry, is chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And as he just mentioned, he's formed an organization called Business Initiative for Healthcare to combat the disinformation that's going to be hitting us like a broadside and has already started in terms of big insurance going after the Democratic candidates Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Kamala Harris, who all support a system of government insurance, leaving a small role for private insurance. Former Vice President Joe Biden and Mayor Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, support giving people the option to get government-run health insurance while letting private insurance remain for those who want it. Let's talk a bit about the tactics here. When you look at single payer around the world, right next door in Canada and in Australia and in the UK, in none of those cases, Wendell, do they replace private insurance. The longest serving healthcare system, which the British people really like, the National Health Service, you can always go to a private doctor. There's all these Harley Street specialists available, and people who don't want to get the sort of free healthcare, if you will, which they pay for through their taxes, can go to Harley Street. So it seems to me that a political mistake to make it sound like you're going to take away health insurance, private health insurance, and substitute it with 100% government health insurance. Why not have choice? Why not use the word public option?
Because you were just adding to the complexity of a system, and one of the reasons why we have the most unequal and expensive healthcare system in the world with some of the worst outcomes in the developed world is because of the enormous complexity, and adding a public option would just increase that and do nothing to control healthcare cost. And that's one of the big reasons why employers are getting into this work, because the cost of healthcare is just not sustainable. The public option, what we have seen with Obamacare, is that it largely left health insurance companies intact. Not only that, it gave them a new lease on life. A feature of private insurance and a feature of a public option, most likely, is, in fact, I'm sure it would be the case, is it would mimic the health care plans we have now, which are increasingly unfair and of increasingly less value. Here's an example. More and more people are being pushed into plans with high deductible plans, with high deductibles. And I knew this was one of the reasons I left my old job. If you have a system that continues to have private health insurance companies, they're going to continue to largely control the system, and they have no incentive to control costs. As costs go up, they're able to increase their premiums. So I'm firmly in favor of just going fully to a Medicare for All type system. Now, keep in mind, when we're talking about choice, under our current system, the choice of providers is increasingly shrinking for Americans, particularly those who have private, exclusively for those who have private insurance. In the traditional Medicare program, you can go to whatever doctor or hospital you want to. In a private plan and under a public option, you would find those increasingly restricted. You would not be able to go to a lot of doctors and hospitals that you might choose. That's just the way insurance has developed. And not only are you having to pay more out of your own pocket to get care before your insurance kicks in, you are increasingly being limited on which providers you can go to and having to pay more and more for drugs. So the public option sounds good. It sounds like a good remedy, but it will just add enormous complexity and additional cost to the system. You know, 10 years ago, I was an advocate of the public option. It was the best we could get at that time. There were no presidential candidates who were talking about single-payer health care. It was not legitimate to do that yet. It is now, because people are realizing the system we have now is not sustainable, and adding a public option will just add a few years more to a system before it really crashes.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of political strategy and branding. In other words, the latest poll from Politico says that 55% of voters support a Medicare for All system when they're told it would diminish the role of private insurers, but that people could keep their doctors. So
yes,
I think exactly. It's a question of how you present it.
It is.
And a previous poll said that when they told, you know, do you support Medicare for All, there was 53%. So it's gone up because once they're told that they can keep their doctors. So
you're right.
I'm talking about not making it sound monolithic, that you'll have no choice. You'll still have some choice. But let's talk about another aspect, and you just mentioned about employee-based healthcare and how employers are realizing they can't handle these rising costs. And you know, that was one of the reasons why some of the big corporations, these like the big three auto companies, were starting to move their plants to Canada, because healthcare is such a huge burden. And in Canada, of course, because the government picks up the burden, it's actually good for private industry and private corporations. And that's why I think the American capitalists are so damn blind in being so much against Medicare for All. It's better for their bottom line. It takes a massive burden off them. But for whatever reasons, maybe ideological, they're sticking with big insurance. But let's take the model of Kaiser. Everybody that I know that uses Kaiser loves it. And that's an employee-based system, isn't it? Employer-based system, isn't it?
It is, but not exclusively, because Kaiser does sell coverage on the exchanges in the states where they operate. So you can enroll in a Kaiser plan through the exchanges and not have to be employed. You're right; it is largely based on employment. And if we had a Kaiser plan all over the country, I think it'd be great. We don't. And in fact, when Kaiser has tried to expand beyond its, where it has been for many years on the West Coast, it has not done so well. So you have that. What is so good about the Kaiser system is in some ways, it's sort of like the UK system. Kaiser employs the doctors, and it owns the hospitals. And it also provides the insurance. I think it would be wonderful for Kaiser to continue with the model it has, but the financing would just shift to a single-payer system. You would still have the Kaiser hospitals and doctors. I think there could be a good transition. So I do agree with you. Kaiser is a good model, and a lot of people do like it.
Well, so don't you think that Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Kamala Harris should integrate that into their plans? Because again, I think you got to present this as not limiting choice, but expanding choice and cutting costs.
Oh, you're exactly right. And I think that the advocates have not really been in the messaging game yet. I think that it will change. And the candidates, you know, there's so many issues that they can and need to deal with or address at one point or another. The word choice. When I was in my old job, it was one that we used relentlessly, because we know that is a term that Americans in particular find positive for them, and the term competition. So you'll hear the words choice and competition from the insurance industry quite a bit. What we need to do is make sure that people understand that the insurance industry over the past several years has been slowly and methodically taking choice away from you, taking choice of drugs away from you through the formularies, taking choice of doctors and hospitals from you. Under Medicare for All, your choice increases dramatically in many cases. No longer will you have a health plan that has a limited number of doctors that you can see. So in that sense, we need to make sure that we're using the terminology in a way that works for the advocates of healthcare reform, not against us, and that can be done.
So in terms of the other issue, and we talked about the vertical integration of these big companies buying up pharmacy chains as well, Big Pharma, of course, is a big part of the same problem, along with big private health insurance monopolies. The prescription drug prices have risen four times faster than inflation just in the past 6 months alone. And as we know, Medicare and Medicaid are prohibited from negotiating bulk prices and reducing the cost of pharmaceuticals. And we also know that President Trump has promised to do something about it. He said he was going to negotiate like crazy with drug makers. Nothing has happened. It's one of the many phony drain-the-swamp promises of Trump's. But don't you think the Democrats can seize on that? Do you have any ideas, Wendell, of how to integrate this problem? Because everybody knows they get sticker shock every time they have to buy medication, and particularly elderly people who depend upon the medication. How would you approach that in the context of Medicare for All?
Well, it does need to be integrated. In fact, it is. In fact, the legislation, both the House and the Senate, would change and would put into place a mechanism in which we would have something that is like the rest of the developed world. The National Health Service in the United Kingdom, which is part of what the National Health Service has a mechanism for evaluating drugs and making sure that people in the UK pay an appropriate amount for their medications that every other developed country in the world does. You're right. The drug industry in this country has been able to manipulate politicians into prohibiting the government from taking any kind of actions to control health care costs. Under the Medicare for All legislation, that would change. You would have the government stepping in to finally playing a pivotal role, as it does, for example, in the Veterans Administration program. That is the one program, the federal program, that does negotiate for drugs, and they're paying. Veterans are able to benefit from that, but those who are enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid, as you pointed out, and the rest of us who have private insurance, we don't have that benefit.
Well, just in closing, you've made a good, clear case, Wendell, that Medicare for All is the way to go. It's just a question of selling it right. Is that the bottom line?
It is, and who is the messenger selling it? That's important, too. I'm going to be very much involved in helping to develop the communication strategy around selling it. But employers, like I said earlier, are beginning to get in the game. And as Warren Buffett has said, the U.S. healthcare system is the tapeworm that is destroying American competitiveness. So when you're saying business leaders like that step up and say things like that. And his partner, Charlie Munger, is a Republican who has said that he thinks a single-payer system in this country is inevitable and what we need. So you're starting to see not only the message taking shape in a more effective way, but the messengers will include business leaders as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Wendell Potter.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry, is the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and the founder of Tarbell.org, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And he has formed an organization called Business Initiative for healthcare to combat disinformation coming from big insurance bent upon destroying the possibility of Medicare for All. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.